Defense Information Systems Agency has taken an interesting approach to cloud computing as it transitions from the sole broker for the DoD commercial cloud market. DISA recently released what it terms a best practices guide to help DoD agencies buy their own cloud services. Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu writes about this and several other matters in this week's edition of Inside the DoD Reporter's Notebook.
We've seen so many conferences where we talk about the best practices in government for buying cloud. I mean, I think what was notable about this is it's the Defense Information Systems Agency itself releasing this. And they really did a good job, I think, of looking across DoD in sort of the nascent effort to actually buy commercial cloud services throughout the military, because it has been really slow to get off the ground. Other notable thing is this showed up on DISA's Information Assurance website, which is usually where DISA posts things like security technical implementation guides and security requirements guides, all the check boxes you have to mechanically go down to make sure that software and hardware is safe to use on government systems. This is not prescriptive at all. Rather, it just, and in fact, in big red letters on the first few pages, it says this is not official DoD policy. This is just sort of some guideposts of, again, what other DoD agencies have experienced as they go out and purchase commercial cloud services from the private sector. So I think it's an interesting read. I think DISA in some ways should be congratulated for, in a way, going out on a limb here instead of just writing prescriptive policy, trying to give some more generic advice to DoD agencies who are considering going this direction, which, again, is the guidance from the DoD CIO. Make more use of this stuff.
And this is all fallout from the days when DISA was the sole broker for DoD. Now they're out of that role, so therefore, guys, you're on your own. Here's the best we can do for you.
That's right, and they don't seem to be holding any grudges from that decision. They, as you say, they used to be the sole gateway through which defense agencies were allowed to buy commercial cloud services. Now they're in charge of setting the security standards, again, those STIGs and those SRGs, and they seem to have taken the initiative here and actually advised agencies on how to purchase from the commercial sector, since they do now have that authority to make their own procurement decisions.
All right, so we'll have a link to that whole guide at federalnewsradio.com, search Serbu. And the Defense Health Agency is like the blob. It keeps acquiring more and more medical organizations and getting bigger and bigger.
Three more coming into the fold as DHA moves forward towards its October 1st target date to become fully operationally capable. The Armed Forces Health Surveillance Center, the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System, and the National Museum of Health and Medicine officially became part of DHA.
Is that the one where they have all these weird samples in jars that are horrible to look at?
That's a good question. I've never been there, but I'm curious to go there now before it. As you mentioned, that used to be called the Army Medical Museum.
Oh, yes. Back, don't take the children.
goes back far in history. One thing I learned as I was writing the notebook this week, just after the Civil War, it was founded. And although it's basically a museum in the way that we think about a museum today, it used to do a lot of the things that we think about organizations like CDC and NIH doing. It used to be like a legitimate research laboratory. So they found the cause of yellow fever and helped develop the vaccine for typhoid fever. It was kind of the forerunner for what's now the National Library of Medicine. Anyway, that's one of the three organizations coming into the DHA fold. And all three of these are kind of a natural fit for the Defense Health Agency anyway, because they're some of the few organizations that are not solely serving the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps. They serve all of the military branches and the splintered surgeons general who run those organizations, which is kind of the whole point of DHA in the first place, is to provide shared services across the three military departments and their medical system. So that move seems to make some sense.
And is the Defense Health Agency a three-star command or a four-star?
It is a three-star command. Lieutenant General Doug Robb is the commander, and he will be their first full-time commander once they hit FOC on October 1st. Not that he's not full-time now, but he's working hard, I'm sure, but they're only at their initial operating capability stage at this point.
He must be a doctor. I mean, he must be a an MD.
That's an excellent question. I believe that's true, but I can't swear to it. That's who you would imagine would be running the Defense Health Agency, but I'm not completely certain that he's an MD.
Well, if they keep absorbing, maybe it'll get to be a four-star command once it gets big enough.
Yeah, it may indeed.
All right. And the other thing, by the way, we're speaking with Federal News Radio's DoD reporter Jared Serbu, and we heard yesterday that you had been speaking with the RAND Corporation about the question of whether the Army is going to be big enough. And you talked to Tim Bonds, the vice president of their Army Research Division. And this is getting to be more debated, I guess, this idea of the constant downsizing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the noteworthy thing from the RAND study, which they actually presented last week to the Commission on the Future of the U.S. Army, which is this independent panel that's looking at what the size and structure of the Army ultimately should be. I mean, I think the notable thing here is that RAND is not necessarily saying you you need a bigger army for the sake of having a bigger army, but they are saying that your army needs to be matched with the missions that you've set out for yourself in your national security strategy and the quadrennial defense review. And their conclusion is it's definitely not, especially if you go down to the 450,000 active duty soldier level. The QDR, Rand points out, was written before a couple really big things happened in the world. One, the Islamic State taking over huge portions of Syria and Iraq, and also Russia's move into Ukraine, which kind of signals to a lot of people that the Russian government is willing to use military force to expand its borders, including, importantly, into NATO territory, where we have treaty obligations to defend. So I think the main conclusion in the RAND study and the reason why they think you need more soldiers than what were anticipated in the QDR is that in order to have a credible deterrent in those Baltic states where we're worried about, you really need to have probably about a brigade's worth of soldiers in each one of those countries. Right now, there's only about a company of U.S. soldiers on the ground there, which they say is just not a credible deterrent. They would be overrun by Russian forces if they decided to invade within, I think the estimate was 36 to 70 hours, they would be in Russian capitals. So if we're going to uphold our treaty obligations, you really need more people to do it, is their conclusion.
Yes, and with 490 or 470,000, I think there's even estimates way out of 420,000, you can't put that many people on the field. You can probably only field about half that many at a given time that are actually in a state of, you know, pure readiness.
That's a really important point. I think the ratio is something like you need about 160,000 people in the generating force to field a force of about 90,000. So there's a lot of people who are training. There are people who have just been recruited and are going through basic training, so they're obviously not available to deploy. Obviously, you have some smaller portion of people who are ill or wounded. They're not deployable. And then you have people who are just providing sort of enabling capabilities that are not the traditional boots on the ground. So yeah, even if you have an army of 490,000, which we do today, not even close to that number is actually available to go out and, you know, fight wars in the traditional sense that we think about.
I mean, there is a school of thought that says size and readiness are overrated because if, say, China was going to mount some sort of a giant land offensive, we would know about it in time through surveillance and so on and spying well in advance so we could get our act together to counteract it. So that's the other school. Who knows?
In a scenario like that, you would like to believe that Congress would find the money to actually to generate ready forces and get us out of the sort of training deficit that the Army and the Marine Corps are in right now. So yeah, it's a good point. But at the same time, it does take time if you want to grow the size of especially a land force. It takes a good year or two to generate a sizable number of forces, as we saw in Iraq when we tried to grow the army. It eventually successfully, but a lot of things had to happen, including reducing recruiting standards, taking people with criminal records that wouldn't have been previously accepted. So you do make some compromises when you want to grow quickly.